It's 3 o'clock somewhere. Time for a My Mochi ice cream snack. My Mochi ice cream is cool, creamy scoops of premium ice cream wrapped in sweet, pillowy dough. And get this, all of My Mochi's fabulous flavors like strawberry, mango, double chocolate, and cookies and cream are only around 80 calories per piece. Talk about a guilt-free, indulgent experience. Each box of My Mochi ice cream has 6 perfectly portioned, gluten-free mochis that are great for grab-and-go. So feel good while curbing your afternoon cravings or the midnight munchies. Yeah, you know who you are with the joyfully chill sensation of My Mochi ice cream. Find My Mochi ice cream at Target or visit MyMochi.com to locate a grocery store near you.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
Welcome to the ID10T podcast number 988. I just want to thank everyone who came out to Brea, California, to the Improv at Brea the last weekend, the 22nd, 23rd of February. Those were the dates. Why am I going up so high? Thank you so much. The shows were a blast, and I am very excited to go to San Diego is the next stop, the American Comedy Company, March 7 through 9. Tickets and info are available at AmericanComedyCo.com. So come out and see that. But now let's talk about the ID10T Community Corkboard. Events at ID10T.com is the email that you're going to want to send stuff to, like Daniel Fox, which is a great name, who writes, I recently released my second novel, Lies That Bind, about a young man and his family being chased by a crazed lunatic wearing, he wrote in parentheses, magic? Pink sunglasses. Is this man from the future? From the past? Or is he really just crazy? What other secrets does this man hold, and how does he keep finding them? You can pick up my new novel, Lies That Bind, or my previous novel, In the Dark, at Amazon, iTunes, Barnes & Noble's website directly, or from him at danielfoxbooks.com. Also, Colleen writes, I'm a super beginner photographer with a love of local history and tourist attractions, museums. I took these loves and started my Facebook page, The Domestic Tourist. It is like Idiot Abroad, except that I'm the idiot and abroad is my hometown, Philadelphia. The idea started when I would hit local tourists or historical spots, and then others who live here would say, it's in my own backyard and I've never been. If you're interested in learning some random facts about Philly landmarks, the page is facebook.com/domestictourist. Which is T-O-U-R-O-R-I-S-T. Or Instagram is Domestic Tourist. That's the Instagram account. I hope you go to the Mütter Museum, because that place is amazing if you like vintage medical oddities. Guys, the largest impacted colon in the history of saved impacted colons. Why wouldn't you want to pay to see that? I don't understand. It's amazing. So that's that. This episode is Chris Sullivan, who is the dearest, sweetest human being. Chris is on a tiny little startup show called This Is Us, which actually is probably one of the biggest shows on television. And he also plays Taserface in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. And he does music. He has great suits. He did a podcast for an organization and a website called To Write Love on Her Arms, which is TWLOHA.com. And To Write Love on Her Arms is an organization that's dedicated to helping people get help for various mental illnesses and self-harm. And Chris did an episode of the podcast on December 18th of 2018. So listen to that. He is a wonderfully sweet, empathetic, just lovely specimen of a human being. And this, by the way, this podcast was recorded in December of 2018 at my home before the new podcast studio was done. So slowly in the coming weeks and months, they're going to start trickling in and being mixed in with the new podcast studio, which I will post pictures of very soon on the Instagram account at Hardwick or at ID10T. I don't know. I got to figure out how to balance those two things out. But Chris Sullivan, love him. Watch everything he does. He deserves it. This episode was brought to you by Robinhood, which is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos all commission-free. You know, while other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all your profits. Plus, there is no account minimum deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy-to-understand charts and market data, and place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections, such as 100 Most Popular. With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio, discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right movement to invest. So you never miss the right moment to invest. Robinhood is giving listeners of ID10T a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. Sign up at id10t.robinhood.com. This episode also brought to you by Squarespace. Why don't you head on over to squarespace.com/ID10T for a free trial when you're ready to launch. Use the offer code ID10T to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain, because you can turn any idea that you have into a new website. You can showcase your work. You can just blog if you want. If you want to publish content, do it on your own terms, not the terms of service of some social media platform. Sell products and services of any kind. Promote your physical or online business. Announce upcoming projects you might have. You're going to get a bunch of beautiful templates created by world-class designers and e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online. Everything's optimized for mobile right out of the box. You can buy domains, choose from up to 200 extensions, and analytics are going to help you grow in real time. Also, 24/7 award-winning customer support. So make it yourself easily. Create a website by yourself. Make it stand out. Stand out with a beautiful website. Again, squarespace.com, ID10T, squarespace.com/ID10T. Go there. Use the offer code ID10T to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the ID10T podcast number 988 with Mr. Chris Sullivan.
Let us roll the thing. Taserface demands that you roll the thing. This is not a good Taserface impersonation. I'm going to stop now. It almost went into Bane a little bit. I'm Bane's a face.
Initiating ID10T protocol.
Someone's house. Can't show up empty-handed.
God, no one has applied this theory yet. This is fantastic.
Double cherry, not single cherry. That's double cherry cheesecake.
You know, I'm telling you, I'm going to eat this while blasting the Warrant song.
I saw a House of Pies on the way, so I figured...
Oh, thank you so much. This is beautiful. I can't thank you enough.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Chris Sullivan bearing a pie. Fucking
we should
gorgeous.
We should put it in a fridge or something.
Oh, that's a good idea. You mean I shouldn't just let it sit here and get warm?
Either way.
Oh my gosh, I can't even.
I only have one other friend who has a gate like that. And so either you or her has to set up some kind of speaker that...
Oh, because of the wooden gate.
Like,
that is not only a great
you
idea.
Would do, Mandy won't do it. You might.
Fuck yeah, I will.
Oh, I would love that.
But people are driving in. I don't know if they necessarily hear it, so we'd have to tell people, like, roll down your windows.
Well, they have to push the button, right? You push the button, and then something that triggers when you open the gate.
I had some friends many years ago that made up lyrics to that song, and I wish I could remember all of the lyrics, but it's all I hear when I hear the song now, which is, I'm a dinosaur, and sometimes I roar. Like, that's all I can hear in my head.
Wasn't there some famous UCB guy or something that did the entire movie of Jurassic Park in 5 minutes? Like, he did every character and all the dinosaurs.
Oh, my God. I don't know. I know there was a guy that did the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I saw him. He did everything by himself, which was, which was a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a lot to cover. That's a lot. I mean, it was really fun. I'm sure someone did the same thing with Jurassic Park. We should do it with movies like Police Academy.
Yeah. Really bring those back. I remember, there are certain movies that you watch when you're young, and then you, as an adult, look back on watching them and are like, I should not have been watching those movies.
Oh, yeah.
It's a little bit of, there's a little Russian roulette with old movies, because when you saw the movies, you were young, and they completely broadened the scope of what entertainment was for you.
Right.
And so they were amazing. Some of them hold. Like, right. Pee-wee's Big Adventure holds.
Yeah, really holds.
3 o'clock High holds. Beetlejuice holds.
Beetlejuice is one that I used to watch over and over and over again, and I went back and watched it as an adult, and it is so vulgar. And for a 9-year-old, like, he goes to a whorehouse. He goes to a ghost whorehouse.
I guess that's true.
He goes to a miniature ghost whorehouse.
Why does miniature make it creepier for somehow? They're just tiny. Everyone is just tiny ghost fucking.
A tiny devil house of prostitution.
And the woman, and then the caseworker who had her throat slit is the one who set up the whorehouse to distract him.
Right.
And it works.
Right.
Yeah, I guess
smokes through her? No. She smokes regularly, but
and
the
smoke comes
out
of her neck.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's true. I hadn't really thought about it.
There's it's mostly just forming our young sexualities. Like, everything else, like the violence and all of those things, I guess we would see anywhere, but
well, especially now.
Are they redoing? They're doing a second one, right?
You almost just did a Beetlejuice.
Oh, yeah. No. He was my favorite growing up.
Like, he's so good in that movie.
Phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And it's a performance that couldn't be duplicated. No one else, I don't think anyone else could have pulled that off.
No.
There was just something about him that he managed to, or just sort of the magic of Tim Burton and him.
Mm-hmm.
And also, a lot of credit to Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis, who played so sincere and straight.
So straight.
To the opposite, to balance out this fucking insanity of the Dietzes and Beetlejuice and that world. It was so perfectly balanced. So perfectly balanced.
There are a few filmmakers who come up with original stories, not like the story structure, but the ideas. Like, Beetlejuice isn't based off a fairy tale. It's not based off an old legend. It's
right.
Not based off an old myth. It's like an original story. The stuff with M. Night Shyamalan recently, Mr. Glass, he's creating his own superhero universe.
Right. Yep.
No one's done that in how long?
That's not based on a comic book or anything.
Right, yeah. Right. That's out of thin air.
Well, you know who's done that to wildly successful degree is the Conjuring universe. They've done it. They've done an amazing job building off the closet of possessed oddities that the Warrens have.
Is that what I walked past on the way?
You did walk. Listen, it's probably not a surprise to you that my wife is obsessed with the Warrens.
Yes,
and can tell you a lot about the shit they have in their closet.
Yeah.
And
and the marionette is from The Conjuring.
The dummy?
Yeah.
He's from a movie called Dead Silence.
Right.
He's an actual used...
From the movie.
Yes, actual from the movie. And the thing that's great about that dummy is that he has a remote control.
No.
So his mouth opens and his head moves. And
at your whim.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you control him until he's had enough, and then he controls you. That's how that works.
I love it.
That's kind of how that works. So yes, it is. I guess we don't live so much in a house as a house of curiosities,
which I love so much. I aspire. I'm not kidding.
I never thought about the Beetlejuice thing before. It's going to tickle me for days.
It's a kids, quote unquote, kids movie.
Yeah.
It goes to a little miniature whorehouse.
But.
And is constantly trying to have sex with Gina Davis.
I mean, he's just being gross and just being generally gross and pervy the entire time, because he's just he's a disgusting entity. But I am glad, because I feel like they always sort of talk about, oh, we're going to do a sequel. We might do a sequel. Mm-hmm. A sequel could happen. I just hope they don't go let's do a prequel. Let's find out who beat him. I don't – that's a little midichlorians to me. I don't need to know where he came from. I just know what he is and how he is in that universe. But I just don't know if – I mean, if anyone could pull it off, I think that group could pull it off.
And they're all around and they're all primed for something like that if Tim Burton's got an idea. Tim, if you're listening, the Chris's would appreciate a Beetlejuice.
I guess I just wonder if the problem with, making a Ghostbusters sequel or a Back to the Future sequel or a Matrix sequel or, if they talk about a Beetlejuice sequel, it's sort of like everything worked the first time because there was magic. And it's organic. Mm-hmm. What happens when they go and do a sequel is they have to not only build on the stakes of the original because you've already seen it, but then they usually just kind of go in and home in on the things that were accidentally magical.
Right.
Push the things.
Of a time.
Yeah.
Of a place.
Yeah. And so that makes it sort of difficult because it's got to kind of be its, how do you make it its own thing while still honoring the original, while not milking too many of the, it's it's becoming aware. It's the more, Naked Gun was amazing. Naked Gun 2.5 was great. Mm-hmm. Naked Gun 33 1/3. It's now they're all really aware. Now everyone's a little too aware of it.
Right. At what point do you?
And I still love it.
Right. Do you instead of creating something original? At what point do you start? I think one of the things with This Is Us is the writers and Dan Fogelman are really careful to not start making episodes of This Is Us.
Right. Yes, that's exactly right.
To keep telling the story that made the show connect with people without leaning into the things that people have pointed out that they enjoy.
And yet, you're in a wildly successful popular sequel to a movie. Right. But the difference being that was always kind of planned.
Mm-hmm.
And I think comic book movies are the exception because they are inherently serialized stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so going into it, it's not like a lot of the movies we're talking about were self-contained. This was in an era when people didn't automatically think trilogy.
Right. What would you even call these movies now? I mean, now the trilogy...
They're franchises. They're just movie franchises.
Yeah.
So it really just depends on some of the biggest heartbreakers are Fletch Lives, and you're Fletch, arguably one of the best comedies in the history of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And then Fletch Lives, it's like, okay, now they're all making a Fletch movie.
Right.
And it just some of the magic is,
Chevy. Chevy.
This Is Us, when the This Is Us sequel series comes out, where they just spin off.
It's
origin stories.
Yeah.
When they do This Is Us babies, like Muppet babies. But
or just everyone in old makeup, in old age makeup. All right, we'll just take it from here. It's them in a home.
That was them. There they are.
Yeah, This Is Us talking, This Is Us talking about This Is Us, and that was them. What was the show, the after show we were going to do?
That was them. You're in such rarefied television air. I mean, there are just not that many wildly successful and not a genre show.
Mm-hmm.
Walking Dead genre, Game of Thrones genre, both massive. This Is Us, people drama.
Yeah, people drama.
Just a people drama.
Relationship drama.
I mean, when the fucking trailer for that show gets 100 million views, before it came out. Like, that is mind-boggling to me how that happens.
Yeah, people were scrambling around when that, the Facebook trailer dropped to kind of reassess the length of contracts, things like that. Because at the time when I auditioned for that show, I was still attached to the Nick, Soderbergh show, and we weren't sure if it was going to go another season, and so I only signed up for a year of This Is Us, and then that trailer dropped. And by the time the trailer dropped, I was no longer attached to the Nick.
Right.
And NBC said, "Hi. How would you feel about 6 years?"
Yes, please. I would feel pretty good about that at this juncture.
It worked out well for all of us.
Yeah, because you never know. Like the way that television shows, at least traditionally, worked was, you know, you'd go through pilot season, you'd audition for a show. They make a test deal before you even have your final audition.
Right.
And then you know what the terms are, which fucks with your head. You're like, I'll make how much?
Right.
And then, you know, they lock you into like a 7-year deal.
Yeah.
And that's a good news, bad news.
Right.
The good news is, oh, your show gets picked up a lot. The bad news is, your show gets picked up a lot, and now you're on a show that maybe you don't love anymore. You know, like shows change, things change, and you know, and then you get to be kind of a spoiled actor.
Yeah,
and be
you're
like,
kind of
I don't like that. Well, you're being paid, man. I don't care.
Yeah, and that's the hard part about,
you don't have to like what you're doing.
Exactly. You know, feeling fulfilled in some kind of way. So far, the great news is, and I think the reason the show kind of connects with people the way it does, is that it's mathematically impossible how well we all get along. Like, from the top to the bottom, from Dan Fogelman through the whole cast, our producers, it's we have a lot of fun and we enjoy being around each other. So I think that kind of translates. So
maybe season 3 or 4, they just start sliding genre and like, maybe you're a vampire?
Yeah, I keep trying to work things like that in. Like, we just had an episode where the doctor, our fertility doctor, says, well, we've done the tests and there were no DNA abnormalities with the fetus. And when they were doing my coverage, I kept going under my breath, really? or going, oh, that's weird.
Does it skip a generation?
Yeah, like trying to like feed it, like all of a sudden the baby can levitate or as a
Twilight wolf.
Yeah, you find out that This Is Us is just a prequel for some other show like Lost.
I always wonder, and no one will ever do this, but I always wonder what would happen if a show like in the final season or well into a show just like flip genres just to see. Just to see what would happen.
Yeah, if it's running out of steam in season 6, give it a 7th and flip it.
Yeah.
Flip it into, prequel for The Walking Dead.
I mean, if you know it's going to be the last season anyway.
Yeah.
Like, why not?
Yeah, why not?
And again, I think This Is Us will run for 100 years. Like, this show is going to be on. The show's going to be on for a while.
Yeah, Dan has an endpoint in mind, which is another reason why I think the show does so well, is that he's not writing open-ended.
Like Breaking Bad.
Like, there's a goal with where he wants to kind of wrap it up. And I think he's said 6 or 7 seasons, something like that. I'm not sure. But
So sweet.
But yeah, it'd be great. You know, Randall and Beth move down to Atlanta, and all of a sudden Rick shows up, like in a storyline.
Yep.
Yeah, and we can just make it a prequel.
You can make it a prequel
to The Walking Dead.
Well, I think Breaking Bad, I've said this a million times, but I think Breaking Bad is the prequel to Walking Dead.
That's right.
Because the timeline, I think, pretty well lines up.
Perfect.
Because Walking Dead is like, the apocalypse for them starts around 08, I think. Mm-hmm. And Breaking Bad starts around 05, I think, 04, 05. And so my theory is that Heisenberg dies.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert. If you didn't watch Breaking Bad by now,
too late.
You don't get to get upset about
that.
And so in his absence, some cartel tries to recreate the blue meth, which creates the apocalypse.
Right.
Like, that's the thing that triggers the
apocalypse. Turns out they're not zombies. They're just meth addicts.
They're just meth addicts. They just need to go dry out for a while.
They're not dead.
No. Yeah. They're dead. Like, they're emotionally, like, they just need to be rehabilitated. That's all they need.
Dead inside.
Yeah, they just need to be a little bit, they just need a little bit of that. Because they did, in season 2,
they connected the universes because Merle has in his satchel a bag of blue meth, which was a nod.
Oh, that's right.
So they actually did. That is connected, they actually did some of the legwork on that.
Oh, Rooker.
I mean, what they just need to do is have Jesse Pinkman show up in the apocalypse. Like,
perfect. No, I like it. Swing around Toby.
Stop trying to eat my neck, bitch. That's all they need That's all they need to do. Or listen, I look enough like Aaron Paul, I could show up as Jesse Pinkman.
There you go.
On The Walking Dead.
I like it. God. See, now we're creating work for ourselves.
Connecting universes. Yeah, that's it. Is there another television universe? Any two universes you would connect you could?
I mean, The X-Files was the show that brought me like to television, like to adult television. Mm-hmm. That was the first show where I walked into the living room of my parents and said, can I stay up late? Uh-huh. Hey, can I stay up 30 minutes late? I had missed the title card. So I said, there's this show called The Truth Is Out There.
Yep.
And I'd like to investigate
it. I want to know what the truth is.
Yeah.
And where is it out there?
That show blew my mind. You go back and look at that show and every major character actor who's playing in film today is working on that show. Jack
Black.
It
was world class. It was, I mean, and I think despite the shoulder pads that everyone had, I think the old series holds up quite well.
Yeah. Gillian Anderson was my first celebrity crush.
Have you met her?
I've avoided it.
She's really cool.
I passed by her at the Emmys and was like, I'll leave it alone.
I'm going to let this one go.
There's no, this is not going to work out.
The meeting in my mind is much better than what's going to happen in reality.
Excuse me.
Hi. And also, especially because you're a tall gentleman.
Myself approaching any woman for any reason is not, it doesn't bode well. My 6'5", 270.
Can we also just talk about you being dapper AF? Like, you have the best hats.
Oh, thank you.
And the best... Your formal fashion wear is on point and spectacular.
I describe my fashion as confrontational.
I would describe it as a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah. Something, I don't know. It's a nod to not trying to take any of this too seriously.
It's fucking great.
Yeah.
I think she would appreciate it personally.
I hope so. She was... What's that? American Gods, where she plays the Bowie character.
Right.
Yeah.
Have you met any other heroes?
You know who? One of the people that was formative for me growing up, you know, just being at home as a kid watching TV is Ray Romano.
Yeah.
And I met him at the SAG Awards, and. And he was one of the people that I'm like,
how you doing?
Yeah. Hey. And I was like, I'm a big fan of yours.
Thanks.
Yeah. And he goes and then he says, I watch your show too.
Oh, I watch your show too.
No way. Get out of here.
Yeah. I watch it all the time.
And I guess we're nominated in the same category.
Oh, go fuck yourself.
And then we agreed that if either one of us should win, that we would get up and hug the other. And so luckily... This Is Us won that SAG award. And who meets me at the front of the stage before I walk up? Ray Romano. And he takes my face in his hands. And he says, I always knew you could do it. I'm so proud of you. And he gives me a hug.
Oh,
and that was one of the best moments of my life. Yeah.
That is fantastic.
Steven Soderbergh's another one. I mean, he was working with him. Was incredible. Working with him is... There's almost nothing you can take away from working with him because nobody else works that way. So like the lessons that you learn working with him, you can only apply to working with him.
The lesson is just work with Steven Soderbergh.
Yeah. It's an incredible experience.
You've worked on a lot of really cool stuff.
Yeah, it's worked out really well.
I mean, it seems to be... But let's go back and talk about a young Chris Sullivan. A young Chris Sullivan who's inspired by the X-Files in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And like, someday I'm going to be up there and I'm gonna do it. Like, what are the roots? Are your roots comedy? Are your roots more theatrical?
Yeah, no. My roots are theatrical. My roots are
unorganized energy or unfocused energy, and my parents trying to figure out where to put it.
You know, where do we aim this kid?
Like, point this kid in a direction. He'll go. We just have to point him in a direction. And I played a lot of sports. I played competitive tennis up into college. But theater, my freshman year, my mom dropped me off at the auditions and was like, I'll be back in an hour, audition or don't. I'll be back in an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a line in, I got one line in The Sting. Have you seen that movie?
Of course.
There's also a stage play.
Yes. Is there really?
Yeah. And it's pretty bad from my remembrance of it. But that was my first play. Did theater all through high school and then went to Loyola Marymount here in L.A.
Yeah.
And studied theater there. Studied a little bit in England. So I did a lot of theater, and then when I graduated LMU with my theater degree and took it around Los Angeles, I said, anyone? Anyone? Huh? Nobody cares.
I got a degree.
Yeah, surprise, surprise.
I got a degree.
Yeah. And most of the work that I ended up doing in LA was theater. Surprise, surprise. But it was small level. So full circle, my very first job, $150 a week, production of The Fantastics, longest running musical on Broadway. They were doing a small production in Westwood.
Mm-hmm.
And the director was one of the writers of The X-Files.
Oh.
And she became kind of my L.A. mom. And her husband, her name's Valerie Mayhew, and her husband's name is Matthew Greenberg. And he is the writer of Reign of Fire, 1408, one of the Halloween films, a big sci-fi writer. And so they kind of became my L.A. parents. And then the first big theater show I got was a Broadway touring show of a production called Defending the Caveman.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which was written by a guy named Rob Becker, who was part of that 80s comedy boom.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the comedy clubs were shuttering after the boom, clubs were starting to close. Work was starting to dry up for just road comics and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He wrote this show with his wife about the differences between men and women. And it was a bit of a sociological study about men being coming from a hunting perspective and women coming from a gathering perspective. And it was one of those shows that kind of came up around the same time as a little bit before the Vagina Monologues and kind of quote-unquote battle of the sexes that happened in like the early 90s. But he took this show, it was like a 90-minute show, one-man show, that was stand-up comedy structure. And he took it around to comedy clubs that were closing and said, I'll do your show or I'll do your club. And he would do like six-month runs in Dallas or in San Francisco and keep the club open.
Wow. And that's just... That's kind of just good branding because it there's something about when people are deciding, like, what am I going to put on pants and leave my house for?
Mm-hmm.
A themed show
makes
a lot more sense. Like, it just feels like there's more value than just a guy that maybe they haven't heard of. I don't know who this is. A show. Right. Oh, what's that? Like, it just gives them something snacky to bite into.
Right. And the theory behind that, or the thesis of the show is women making the statement, men are all assholes, which in the early 90s, there was that kind of thread of home improvement, King of Queens, this bumbling blue collar idiot with a powerful, smart wife. And he's always screwing up and she's always correct.
And she loves him in spite of what a fuck up he is.
Yeah. In spite of what a pig he is.
even though she's... A thousand miles out of his league.
Yeah. And so I think that the outcome wasn't, in fact, not encouraging people to move away from that, but just letting them know it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's okay to just exist in that way. And so this show kind of pushed against that and said, now, men are this way and women, we're different, but that doesn't make one better or better or worse. So it kind of...
Wait, so you toured this, so you did his show?
So he did it. Comedy clubs, then did like a year and a half run in Chicago at a big theater, then went to Broadway, and it's the longest, still to this day, the longest running Broadway one-man show in the history of Broadway.
So how did you do it?
So then he toured it for years, and then he just got tired and decided to hand the show over, and so he handed it over to myself and
Like the Dread Pirate Roberts?
Essentially.
Yeah.
Essentially. And gave us the, you know, the whitewashed jeans and the shitty t-shirt. And it was myself, and I was like 23 at the time, not letting anyone in the production know how young I was. Mm-hmm. They all thought I was at least 30. And then myself and this other guy who was more of a stand-up comedian took over the show. And we traded off, and I toured it on and off for like 4 years and did 1,000 performances. And
oh, my God.
My high school theater professor, who I went back and visited later, said, you know, it might not be Shakespeare, but you have your PhD in stage time.
Absolutely.
Like just standing on a stage alone for what ended up being like an hour and 45 minutes, no intermission, for 1,000 shows. And after that, nothing was that scary anymore.
Well, there's no better training than just being on stage. Yeah. You just can't.
Yeah.
But were you given any leeway to tweak or improv or anything?
No, Rob was pretty concerned with the show going the way he did it. Mm-hmm. And so it was a stand-up comedy show, and he had worked these beats. And we went to Missoula, Montana, and rehearsed with him, I mean, in like a 1,500-seat theater. So it's like the perfect movie scene of like you alone on stage, one guy in the audience halfway up the orchestra watching you do stand-up comedy.
Of his material.
Of his material to an empty room.
Mm-hmm.
And what we had to do first, they paid us first to memorize the whole thing because they wanted to see if we could do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they gave us 2 months and I can't remember how much, they'd like $5,000 to memorize it. And I went back to LMU to the little theater. And at that time, I was walking in circles for 6 hours a day, talking to myself, trying to learn an 85-page monologue.
Oh, my God.
Then they flew us to San Antonio, and we had to perform it again in an empty theater for this guy who created it until we got the job, and then we started touring it. And so we had to do it pretty to the T, but there obviously, you know, when you're doing stand-up or you have a beat, you probably develop 4 or 5 different ways that you can approach it based on everything that's happened before. You know, the type of audience, how the other jokes have gone. Am I going to speed through this? Am I going to lean into it? Am I going to? And it becomes more of a, you know, a show that long becomes more of a math problem after 1,000 performances. So it was an amazing experience.
I mean, were there some shows where you're like, I don't know if this is working so much. Oh, I got them back.
Oh, yeah. Like there were shows where I could go for 20 or 30 minutes without a laugh. And still, you know, you have an hour and 15 minutes to go. and the more you push the more I push and like try to get them to laugh, the less they're like, no, we're not coming with you. So it was the last 500 shows were a little more easy, just as far as knowing that the jokes work and knowing not to push and knowing to pace them out and not rush.
Kind of funny, and I guess that show might have cured you of ever wanting to do stand-up. Well, when you do the same, or at least if you want to, because you're basically in Groundhog Day.
Right.
And then all of a sudden you're free, and it's like, oh my God,
yeah.
I could do anything I wanted now.
I did a sit-down run in Norfolk, Virginia that the contract required 8 shows. They didn't have they couldn't sell enough tickets for 8 shows, but they made me do them anyways. And on Saturdays, I had a 2 o'clock, a 5 o'clock, and an 8 o'clock show. So,
how was that 2 o'clock show?
That 2 o'clock show frequently had between 7 and 15 people.
But you got to do it anyway.
In a 300-seat theater. And I would gather them all to the front. They'd be scattered around. I'm like, no, no, no. Everyone sit in the front row and we'll have a nice intimate talk. But I would leave my mic on, go back to the dressing room, lay down, fall asleep. The stage manager would start the next show, which had like an opening video, come back, wake me up. And I would wake up, take a drink of water or whatever, and walk right back out on stage.
Oh my God.
And do that 3 times on a Saturday. And by the 3rd show, I would get lost sometimes. Like, I feel like I've said this before. Have I just doubled back?
Three shows in a day, that happens. 2 shows a day, you can separate the two.
Yeah.
But I've been in the middle of like three show stand-up nights and said like, wait, did I say this already? And the audience will go, no, or yeah. All right, well, you know.
Like some kind of broken
fuck
record.
Fuck you for being the midnight show. How about that? Yeah. That's your fault. That's not my fault.
What are you degenerates doing up this late?
How dare you? Yeah. How dare you appreciate my material to come out and see me and me, you know. What are you supposed to do? Try three times in a day?
But stand-up comedy's always been... The scariest. Because that show, at least there's a character involved. You're playing this guy. Like, I had to wear a fake wedding ring and talk about my wife. Mm-hmm. And even in interviews. Like, when I did radio leading up to a city.
Oh, you had to be in character?
They were like, yeah, you have to, you can't, like, I can't be telling them I'm a 24-year-old single kid.
So, wait, did anyone come to the show that had seen the other guy do it and been like, that's not you?
Yeah.
But
again, it didn't make any sense. But I was 23, and I
wasn't
do whatever
much
I was
of an
told.
Internet at that point. Yeah. So who's really gonna?
Yeah, but it was crazy, man. 32 states, you know, Anchorage, Alaska, where if you show up with a show in Anchorage, Alaska, you might as well be the Rolling Stones. Like we didn't pay for a meal or
just
a drink.
Need something to do.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, that's what landed me in Chicago. And then I stayed in Chicago for 5 or 6 years, which is where I met my wife, Rachel.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. That's really nice. How long have you been married now?
8 years. Been together 10.
Wow.
Yeah. And loving California, full circle. Lived in Chicago and New York, and now we're back.
I mean, listen, say what you want about Los Angeles, but it's mid-December right now, mm-hmm. and it's, what's the temperature outside? It's like 70 degrees or something.
Yeah.
Now, granted, one might argue that our climate is imploding. Someone else might just say...
Who would argue that?
Someone else might just say that we live in a desert, mm-hmm. which we do.
Correct.
And, you know, it's this just... You know, our little latitude and longitude just has this little Goldilocks zone.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody about this the other day because we were talking about Chicago and the winters and New York and all those things. And we were wondering if the weather isn't some kind of external reminder of the passage of time. Mm-hmm. Like here in L.A., I just realized a year passed by. I thought about something that happened a year ago, and it feels like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Because there's been no change, like external sign that time is passing.
Yeah.
It was 70 degrees 6 months ago. It's 70 degrees now.
Don't look. The leaves will just go, don't look at us.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're not going anywhere.
And so like the attitudes in Chicago, you know, when there's that first day where you don't have to wear a jacket outside, the people are so happy.
Oh, yeah.
And so grateful.
It's like people crawling out of the ground in the Matrix at the end. Yeah. That, you know.
Yeah. And it gives people a common struggle. Like there's this – we're all fighting against this thing that's out of our control, the weather, the Mother Nature, whatever it is. And there's always that.
Yeah.
Like that we have in common. And so when summer comes around, people are skipping down the street.
Well, the weather is oppressive in a lot of parts of the mm-hmm. country, and then all of a sudden it just lets up.
Right.
You know, and then – but the only way we know the seasons change is that the ivy on our house mm-hmm. in the winter months –
comes to life.
Goes away, and then in the spring it comes back.
Right.
So think of it as smart ivy.
Is it?
Smart ivy is tuned into
it's the, clock ivy. Yeah. Is it bougainvillea?
It's not bougainvillea. We have that in other parts of the house.
Yeah.
And we all – you know, like – We have a special kind of bougainvillea that blooms year round, mm-hmm. and so it's always very lush.
Yeah,
but that is a very Southern California type of a plant.
Vine.
You see that everywhere, but other parts of the country, and some people do like the changing of the seasons. Mm-hmm. I am not one of them. It just rained in LA for 2 days, and I'm like, enough. Even though I know we need it,
right,
desperately.
Yeah.
At a certain point, it just feels like I just need to see the sky. I mm-hmm. need to see the blue sky.
Yeah, those things that we fight against, or that make life difficult, or that make us have to step out of our rhythm, or like at your level now, like all the things that you do, all the different things that you host. What do you fight against? Like what do you? Because that the things that are hard for me, or difficult, or scary for me, are what make all of this worth it. And so is stand-up still like challenge or what's
well,
the...
Well, sure, yeah. Stand-up's always the most challenging thing, mainly because if you do it properly, mm-hmm. It's a never-ending growth process. Mm-hmm. And at least if you have a TV show, there's an existing structure that you can figure out how you fit into. But with stand-up, it's all you. And you can finish a tour or a special or whatever and go, I guess I don't really have any funny things ever to say again. I guess that was it. There was a finite amount of funny juice and it's gone. And just knowing that you if you just keep doing it, it'll probably be okay. Mm-hmm. You know, you always underestimate your experience.
Right.
That you go through that every time.
Right.
I'd say stand up is probably the
you have to continue to experience things. Like I've heard Bill Burr is kind of the most blatant about it, where he's like, I learned to ride a motorcycle so I could tell jokes about it.
Well, yeah, like, I mean, it's just like any creative endeavor. You can't – all creativity is a re-expression of experience.
Right.
And a repackaging of experience into a way that either is just a pure expression of how you feel or packaged in some way to communicate with an audience
right.
a little more specifically. And so if you're not really experiencing things or – and I think it's sort of why a lot of bands or a lot of comedians when they get older, they sort of fall off the map a little bit
right.
or maybe just don't feel as edgy anymore because it's like they're a lot more – their lives are comfortable.
Well, it's U2, right? One of my favorite bands
I was
of
actually
all time.
Thinking of U2. I was thinking of that band in particular. So, you know, something in between like Achtung and Pop Mart.
Right. And like how do you – if you spend 100% of your time being U2 –
yeah.
And touring songs that you've written about your whatever's happened up to this point.
Yeah.
Then you're not having any – you can't walk into a bar and sit down next to a guy and hear a story.
No.
Or you can't
– you don't relate to – you can't relate – and it's nothing against
them. Or people
them.
Can't relate to you.
They can't relate to you. You're not really having like common human experiences. So you see the sort of – and again, you know, U2 is one of my favorite bands too. But you see their early stuff all the way up through – and Achtung really is – Achtung was a great arty mm-hmm. album, but everything before that was about was so tragic or about MLK or revolution mm-hmm. or, you know, like just this sort of revolutionary Irish experience, you know. And then, you know, Achtung was really great and experimental and arty, and then Pop Mart's like disco. So, you know, it's like it in everything sort of – changes.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Like that's just but you can definitely see that maybe there's a little bit of like, what do we write about now? Like I think I got all the I think I got all that that revolutionary stuff out of my system. So what do we write about? It's a beautiful day.
Yeah. You know? Because it is.
It is.
Because the house is paid for.
Yeah.
The car runs.
Yeah.
Like the human experience of continuing to challenge ourselves, even never mind if there's creative output involved, but how it goes back to the weather. Like the kind of mentality or the what's the stereotype of the Southern Californian, slow-paced,
mm-hmm.
Kind of vain, judgy? Like there's no because we're not railing against because life is easy.
It's so funny though because I think that's the external. I mean, like to me, Los Angeles is like Instagram. It's like a microcosm of Instagram, which is breezy on the outside, diarrhea on the inside.
Oh yeah.
You know,
that's true.
It's like the image. It's all about the I got it covered image.
Right.
But inside, everyone's like, am I fitting in?
Right.
Am I doing wrong?
Right.
Do people like me?
And all of our work events are dressed up as parties.
Yeah.
Like, all they do is part. Like, you go to one of these award shows, and you know that right off camera, the facade ends, and it's just a pile of cables and news trucks.
Yeah. But again, you know, it's like... Yeah. You can post all the Instagram pictures you want about how cool you everything's so – I'm just so chill. This is my Friday feeling. I'm just like a cat yawning on a windowsill, you know. But if you then check your likes, kind of fuck off because it's not – like that's not your – then all of a sudden your Friday feeling isn't your Friday feeling because it's just – you're just using it to monetize your ego.
Right.
You know, like it's – so – and again,
yeah,
I'm not railing on anyone for that. really in a serious way. I've certainly been guilty of it myself, but it's just sort of that idea of like, hey man, everything's totally cool. Oh my God, everything's really not cool. Did they think you're, are they going to know it's not cool? Are they going to be aware that it's not cool?
Right. I just went, I'm from Sacramento. I went home for a couple of days to talk to the students at my old high school. They're having like a mental health
kind of
summit and all these different
events. Showed up as Taserface. Right. Taserface wants to talk about mental well-being.
It's the only way that they would know who I was. And we were talking about that, about trying to pretend like you've got it all together, or trying to pretend like you have all the answers, is exhausting. And it will drive you crazy.
Yeah, I can't imagine being a young person right now and not necessarily understanding. And even as a full-grown adult, it's difficult to remember this sometimes. But judging your life based on what you see in the media or social media, which is a very hyper-reality, an idealization, and feeling inadequate because you're like, oh, that's not my life. And it's like, psst, that's not their life either. You know, it's like knowing
that it's
all, you know, an engineered facade.
And we've set it up for them and given it to them and then turned around and chastised them for using it.
Yeah.
Like adults now use the word millennial like it's the word terrorist.
Right.
And it's insane. Like I've heard Bo Burnham talk about it. Like these kids are just trying to like prove to themselves that they exist.
Yeah. And I am guilty, you know, full disclosure. I used to make fun of millennials.
Me too.
At midnight all the time.
Me too.
More for like the Big Brother thing. It's
Sure.
And then someone pointed out once like, well, my generation's the way we are because of your generation. I was like, fuck, that's impossible to argue. Right. How dare me?
As is any generation that came after the one before it. And it's like these kids, especially at this school, I went to an all-boys Catholic school.
So did I.
Where?
Well, one in Denver, and then I moved out to L.A. my senior year of high school. All-boys Jesuit.
Me too.
Motherfuck. Did you ever get Jug?
All the time.
Yeah!
Now, for those listening, Jug...
Justice under God.
Justice under God was our detention.
Yeah.
It's just detention.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I went to Jesuit High School in Sacramento.
Fantastic.
And this school is all boys. It's high achieving. It's super smart kids, super talented artists, super talented athletes. And so never mind the general pressure of being 15 or 16, but everyone is looking at you to succeed on a level that is, it's unfair. It's an unfair amount of pressure.
You used to just have your peer group to base your performance. How am I? Where do I fit in?
Yeah.
And now it's the entire world.
Right.
And it's not a truthful representation of the world.
Right.
A hyper idealized representation.
The greatest hits version of the world.
Yeah, because we do tend to think that. I think our brains confuse the things that get the most attention with somehow being the most important.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not always the case. It is sometimes the case, but it is not always the case. And so it just the challenge of growing up in our current sort of global digital environment, I think is a tremendous burden
and
for these poor
and
kids.
That goes for good or bad.
I mean, like, why are fucking teenagers having sexual dysfunction because of the ubiquity of porn? It's like, how fucked up, you know, that this is how kids are socializing and not necessarily. And I don't know what the answer is. I don't have a fucking good answer. It's like
it's unconscious. It's unconscious importance being put on either the good or the bad. Like you were saying, whatever is receives the most attention, it is what defines you. So if you succeed, or if you can always look like, if you always have the perfect selfie, and you're always with the coolest people, then that is what defines you. But if you fuck up, then you're done.
I mean, it's,
then that's what defines you, and it's not true.
Every teenager now has the ability to experience what it would have been like to have been on the Brady Bunch. Do you know what I mean? To be famous as a kid, and then hit adulthood, and feel weird. I don't mean to single out the Brady Bunch, and I don't mean to say singled out because I hosted Singled Out.
But you meant it all. Fuck. You meant all of it.
I try to slide that into. Still milking off that, Teet. But I can't imagine. But like every kid now has the ability to experience the unfortunate ability to experience, you know, getting a lot of attention, and then maybe at a certain point it backfiring or them just not getting attention anymore.
Yeah,
and that's really, that's fucked up. Like kids should get to live and learn anonymously and not based on, you know, like and not be under a microscope all the time.
Yeah, it connects the wrong synapses that you know the feeling of acknowledgement or importance with a certain
or what's
activity.
Real? Like what type of appreciation or love is real, right? Or what type of
and you have to go back and rewire those later when your Instagram when Instagram is no longer the thing, like
right.
when you know the number one person on Vine, you know, who he does well, but everybody else, nobody can remember Vine.
Right.
And so it's hard to kind of. Because we won't know. We won't know until 20 years from now what the ramifications of all of this are. But I know just being around the 1,000 students at Jesuit High School in Sacramento, you can see it in their faces. Like they're trying to use comedy to keep people at arm's length or to pretend like they've got it all under control, which is my MO.
Yep,
I'll do
too.
That. But I looked around and I saw just from where I was standing – 6 knees bouncing.
Oh,
just like the unconscious shakes of anxiety, whether it's being at school, having to listen to someone talk about mental health, sitting in the front row, like just this anxiety that comes out through
not being able to check their phone.
Yeah. Yeah. That kind of junkie that we've set up, as far as the reward center of the brain goes, it's too much for kids to deal with. And
do you ever think about how easy it would be to cheat now in today, like with a fucking phone or a smartwatch or something?
Well, I think that's the problem, right? Our entire system of education has to change because the way that we studied for a test to retain information because we couldn't carry the world's library around in our pocket. And now we can. So what's the point? I don't believe that there is as much of a point in proving to anyone how much you can memorize.
Right.
Like
because basically we carry external hard drives around with us.
And if you find yourself in a place where you need the Pythagorean theorem, it's
a squared
at your,
plus it, b squared equals c squared.
That's the one. Mm-hmm. You have it at your fingertips. And if you're going to go into a more specialized, you know, area of this world, then you can focus on that. But it seems to me like we have to work on application of knowledge rather than just short term storing of it.
Yeah, you know, because in the old days, if you wanted to cheat on a test, you had to write it your answers down on a tiny piece of paper and fold it under your watch.
What's paper?
It's a fucking parchment. It's like a...
What's parchment?
It's tree skin. It's a fucking... We skin trees like fucking Buffalo Bill.
Why would you do that?
Because you got erections from it. I don't know. God damn it. Just go get back on your phone.
And then it's like the cycle starts over
because... You just like the kid, you know, it's like you didn't want to take the time to explain things, you know, reasonably and calmly.
Thus commences the existential crisis.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it is kind of funny that people might, again, give millennials a hard time and then, but then not bother to offer any kind of a solution or an outreach or just talk to them. I mean, I don't know. You know?
Yeah, there's an organization I work with called To Write Love in Our Arms that a buddy of mine, Jamie Tworkowski, started. That he had a friend of his who was struggling with drugs, drug addiction, depression, suicide. She had carved the words "fuck up" into her forearms with a razor blade, and because of this, she couldn't get into any rehab. Rehabs were like, she's too high risk. We don't want her committing suicide on our watch. And so Jamie and 3 of his friends took her and put her on their couch and detoxed her as best they could for 3 guys who didn't know what they were doing. And he wrote this online blog about raising money for her rehab. And one of the lines was, we need to find a way to write love on our arms. And that became the name of his organization. And he printed up some t-shirts and he had a bunch of friends on the Warped Tour. And a bunch of the guys, the lead singers, wore the shirts on stage. And that's how they raised money for this girl to go to get help. And so that organization still exists. And I've been working with them as that next step, not just like reach out, don't be afraid to ask for help, but who do you ask?
Right.
Well, this website and this organization connects people with crisis counselors and rehab centers, and even provides scholarships for people who can't afford it. And so I've been trying to kind of support that.
That's fantastic. That I mean, just, you know, no matter what, do not fuck around with your mental health. Do yeah. not fuck around with it. You should absolutely talk to someone, get help, outreach, contact your organization, contact someone. But it's just not something to play, to take lightly.
Yeah, it's super insidious, right? Like it progresses over years. Like it can slip away the mental acuities,
well,
right?
Of course, and in your own self talk, you just think is like, oh, well, that must be the truth, because why would my brain tell me otherwise?
Right.
And it's difficult to know what is authentically you and what is this pattern of chemical misfirings.
Misfirings that we've set up through social media habits and all of these things.
Yes.
And the idea that your feelings aren't facts, they're information. Mm-hmm. Like they're trying to tell you something. They're trying to let you know that something needs to change.
And if you don't have the tool set to sort through them, a healthy tool set, then that's where things can go. Yeah. That's where things can go wrong.
One of the counselors I was working with up north, I wrote it in my speech, and so did she, without kind of talking to each other. And it's like super basic stuff that people don't think about, which is, drink enough water, eat well, get enough sleep, and exercise. Like those four things, we think, yeah, no shit. But they slip away. Like we stay up too late, we get up too early, we don't drink enough water, we eat like shit. And all of a sudden, 10 years have gone by and we can't figure out why we're frazzled.
The eating like shit is particularly, like, talk about insidious, because we have to eat to survive.
Right.
And eating like shit is a self-sustaining depression engine, because you feel bad, so you eat something shitty because that in the moment makes you feel good, just like drinking or drugs or whatever.
Yeah.
But in the long run, it makes you crave more bad food and creates more negativity and more depression, you know, and helps contribute to the depression. And so it's this never ending cycle, and you're just, you know, shoveling bad food into your body and go, I don't know why I feel so bad.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying that it would cure everything if you ate healthy, because it's not, it can, you know, it's eating healthy isn't fun or sexy. Yeah. It's you have to really condition yourself to do it. But when you do, you do notice a difference if you had been on the other side and go, oh my God, that's weird. I just feel good. Oh, I was eating good food. Oh, that's weird. Because we just don't – I think we're not – we don't understand with – it's sort of like fitness. You don't understand it until you do it, and it's difficult to communicate to people. If you did this, it would increase the quality of your life by some percentage.
Right. I found right now in my life, as I am trying to be more conscious about this stuff, if I am angry – anxious, tired, resentful, whatever the negative thing is, chances are I'm dehydrated.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I just don't have the patience or the equanimity to like just let things go or
have a glass of water
and just be present. And it sounds like such simple, stupid stuff, but because it's so simple, we don't even talk about it.
Yeah. And so it's learning to recognize those markers as, oh, your body is telling you that you need, you know, like you should do something healthy, as opposed to like, this is just because everything fucking sucks.
Yeah.
You know, like
your body is panicking.
And we don't have the, you know, I just think it's unfortunately, we just that fucking lizard brain stem is just like a car boot.
Yeah.
Just like on our brain, and it's, you know, we're trying to translate all this very complex information, but we just don't quite have the machine to right. sort through what our brain is capable of processing.
Right.
So it's just it can be a little strange.
Yeah. And moments like this, like the opportunity to speak to somebody, right? To just have a conversation, which we don't really do
right.
anymore.
No.
I've found myself, conversations are where I figure out what I believe.
Right.
Conversations, and I'll say it to my wife sometimes. I'll be like, all right, I'm going to say this out loud. I don't know if I believe it, but I want to say it so I can hear it and find out. Like, you know, you just kind of throw it out there and you're like, I think I'd like to do ayahuasca.
Oh, wait, that sounded weird. Good. I'm glad
now,
I said how
did
it out
that,
loud.
How did that feel when I said it? You know right, what I mean? Yeah. But stuff like that, like... When they asked me to come to do this thing at the high school, everything in my body said, don't do it. That's going to be really 1,000 15-year-olds at 8:30 in the morning. You want to go talk to them. That sounds terrifying. Don't do it. But in the process of writing out my thoughts, I actually figured out a lot about the things I do right in my life and the things I do wrong in my life. And we don't offer each other those opportunities.
Did they seem engaged?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of times we can be of service to each other in many different ways. You can invite me here to have this conversation. And that type of opportunity, that we don't realize that everybody is looking for a little bit of permission, like to be vulnerable or to share the hard shit they're going
or
through.
Or to not be perfect.
Yeah.
To not be a fake idealized yeah. version of themselves, to be authentic and to be,
yeah.
you know.
Every time I've shared some fuck up or some suffering or some anxiety, fear with a friend of mine, without fail, that person has the same fear
right.
or fuck up in right. their life. But we've spent so much time walking around pretending like we're perfect that we think we're alone in that stuff. And it's just, it becomes destructive, especially to young people.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, it might be weird if you just show up at a high school and like, I just want to talk to some kids. Like, that's weird.
Yeah. I waited for the invitation.
What are you doing? Going up to an all boys Catholic high school? Why?
Oh. Talk about mental wellness.
Don't worry about it.
My name's Chris.
You might recognize me.
Sometimes I get sad. Do you ever get sad? God. Raise your hand if you ever get sad. I'll tell you one thing I learned doing this thing is do not go for comedy at 8:30 in the morning with a group of 15-year-olds.
I'll tell you, it's also difficult, and I know this also from sometimes, you know, from doing colleges, which is that if people are young enough, they're still conditioned to see adults.
Right.
Like, they have to pay attention and listen.
Right.
And it's very, unless, you know, unless they're used to it, mm-hmm. it can be a little, they don't know what the proper response
right.
is because they're conditioned to listen and pay
right.
attention.
Right.
And like, oh, that's weird. Why is that adult? Why is this adult doing this? You know,
right.
like it's, I don't think they almost don't trust it.
Sure. And it's so weird because I hadn't been back in that auditorium since my graduation in 1998, so 20 years. And so all of the anxiety came flooding back.
Sure.
Like the room off of the gym was our theater. So the lobby was one of our entrances. So walking back into that building, I remembered every, like, there was one, we were doing Once Upon a Mattress, this musical, and I played the Mute King, and I was so nervous because I had been cast 3 days before we opened.
Oh.
Because the King got fired. Because the King thought dress rehearsal he didn't have to go to, and he would go to a basketball game instead.
Sure.
And so I'm having stomach issues, to put it politely, and it's my time to enter. And I think if I go out on stage, I'm going to shit the stage.
Once upon a toilet.
So I decide not to. I go into the restroom and I can hear silence out there. And my best friend at the time is playing this jester character, and he's just walking around improvising with the audience, doing crowd work until I came.
Oh no! So you're
Ah, we fired this one guy because he went to a basketball game. We put this other guy in. He's fucking shitting in the bathroom.
And so 90 seconds, I'm 90 seconds late for an interview, which in stage time is, I think, 2.5 years.
Not to be gross, but it's really hard to shit under the gun.
Yeah.
To get it. It's like, please, faster. Faster.
But like all of these feelings of anxiety and memories were flooding back, and it was hard to like get on stage in front of 1,000 people. Well, it wasn't hard. I just told them. I was like, I'm terrified right now. You don't understand. It's 20 years since I've been in here, and all these weird feelings are coming up. And
did you tell them the poop story?
And I didn't.
Okay, that's best that you didn't.
I didn't. I didn't have time.
Yeah.
I didn't have time. I got the light.
You know. Okay, I'm going to wrap it up.
But to be, you know, in those situations, the kids were just like we were saying, we're just looking for permission. So when we did the Q&A, a few people had questions about guardians and things like that. But one kid picked up the mic and was like, my heart is racing right now. I'm shaking talking to you. Every day after school, I go home and I go to sleep directly and I don't know what's going on. And that was his comment, like in front of 1,000 of his fellow students.
What did you say?
I related to him my anxiety of working on Guardians, of showing up on the biggest movie of my career and them slapping that makeup on me and having to pretend like I knew what I was doing. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody trains you how to do that. You don't know what you're doing. You just make the choice and you leap. But I was just talking to him about the unfair pressures, everything we've been talking about a kid who's 15 or 16 who's been told that not only does he have to go to school, to a good college, but chances are when he gets out, there won't be a job waiting for him, mm-hmm. and he may have to move back in with his parents anyways.
So what's the point of any of it?
Point?
Yeah. Yeah.
And to be at a school like I'm assuming your school is kind of the same, a group of the city's finest or quote unquote high achievers,
right,
who had to do a little bit of extra work to get into a certain school. It's just a lot. It's just too much. And it should be, they just need permission to talk about that, to have somebody to say, it's okay for you to say that this is too much because it is, mm-hmm. and you'll get through it. And those conversations, it's hard to have them. It's hard to have the context for having them until something bad happens. You know, that one of the coaches at this school a year ago was successful in taking his own life. Oh. And his son goes to that school. And his younger son is about to go to that school. And that's what sparks the conversation. That's what I love about This Is Us, is that we have these conversations about things like depression, anxiety, miscarriage, the death of a father, you know, adoption. When else are you going to talk to your kids or to family or to your friends about miscarriage?
Right.
Your friend gets pregnant. There's no good time to have the miscarriage conversation.
Right. Right.
But it happens. Almost everyone I know who's tried to get pregnant has experienced or had a miscarriage. It happens way more than we talk about, but we just don't have the context to bring up the conversation to let people know that they're not the only one going through it.
Yeah. And, you know, finding ways to get people to find a support group or create a support mm-hmm. group, or again, just talk to each other. I think having conversations, again, like you said, conversations are so valuable, and it's, you know, it's so easy and convenient to not mm-hmm. do that.
Yeah.
You know, so many reasons that it's comfortable to just stay at home
yeah.
and not go do those things. And it, unfortunately, it takes a little bit of effort. You know, it took a lot of effort to go speak to 1,000 kids at 8:30 in the morning, but it's great that you did it. And you know that it was rewarding and it was worth it.
Yeah. I walked away more experiencing more happiness than I've experienced in a long time. But that idea of doing the things that you're afraid of or making an actual connection. Like, it's a cliche at this point, right? We've never been more connected because of the internet and the way things quote unquote connected, but it's false intimacy and it's false honesty. There's still you know, 1,000 miles of fiber optic cable holding each other at arm's length. And to get out of that and to, I went to a hospital recently. My brother just had a baby and there was a list of support groups.
Did he have a C-section?
He did.
See, that was the joke.
He did. Guys. The baby's healthy.
Oh, good.
There was a list of support groups. There's a support group for everything.
Yeah.
Like for everything, every type of cancer, every, you know, leukemia, injury, postpartum.
Yeah, we're not the walk it off generation like our grandparents.
Yeah, and so these places are available.
That's great.
To us if we know where they are and we know that it's okay to kind of look for them. That's the other side of Los Angeles, right? We have this kind of cliche demeanor and this easygoing thing, but I think we're the therapy capital of the country, aren't we?
I mean, we probably are.
Probably. Maybe New York.
New York, LA, you know. Yeah. Well, there's a high concentration of people here too, but there's also a high concentration of people here who work in a field that attracts sensitive people.
Yeah.
Like innately sensitive people in a business that, you know, tries to dismantle every security that you feel and turn it into an insecurity.
Yeah.
If you let it. Yeah. So it is just important to talk and have those conversations.
Yeah. And here we are.
And the fact that I still think you should consider going and doing these talks as Taserface.
The makeup takes 2.5 hours to get into.
Probably an hour to get out of it.
Yeah, that's much easier. They just cut up the back with scissors and then you peel it off like some horror movie.
Yes.
Maybe, you know what? Maybe I won't pressure you into accepting this gift on air, but I'll tell you about it. The makeup team for Guardians of the Galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
Gifted me a framed Taserface head makeup splayed out on a mat and pinned down like a butterfly that I can't hang at my house.
Why not?
It's terrifying. And
you were in the right house.
I'm saying, I was like, I walked in and I was like, you know, this would be a good
I haven't even shown you downstairs. I don't even have to think about it. Even have to think about it.
Okay.
What we could do is...
Because it also feels like a donation to a museum.
And
see it.
Consider it like a museum showing.
Yeah.
Where if at some point you say, I actually really need this back, you could just have it back.
Okay. All right. It's coming. I've already shipped it. I'm Amazon priming it to you right now.
I love that. Oh my God.
Wait until you see it. It's
screen used Taserface.
Yeah, the makeup.
How big is it?
The frame is probably a little smaller than this table. Like there's maybe 6 inches of room around all the makeup, but it's like Silence of the Lambs, like a
I'm going to show you where I think it might actually fit.
Oh, what a day this is.
This is really great.
Because right now, my parents had been storing it under my childhood bed.
Oh, my God. And it's in some sort of a time loop going back.
Yeah. And I love it. And I'm so honored. And the artists who made it. But I'm like, there's no...
As a little Chris Sullivan sees a thing, like the shadow of a thing under his bed.
Yeah.
And it's present day Taserface.
Who, now that you mentioned it, is kind of like Beetlejuice.
When you just did that, I was just about to say the same thing.
It's like Beetlejuice is retired Taserface.
He is.
Who's a little more casual.
Yeah, lost, it's Beetlejuice lost a little bit of his swagger, and he's just trying to, he's been, the old guy at the party.
Yeah, he's been fired up into space.
Taserface, it's so funny. That just to hear you do that, maybe that's where he came from a little bit.
Oh, dude, me putting that makeup on and in my trailer, looking in the mirror and going, "How the fuck do you sound like this guy?" And trying to get words to come out through those teeth, like all of the acting, it was all just me getting around obstacles. Like I couldn't. The whole movie was a blur. I can't see anything out of those contact lenses.
Mm-hmm.
The teeth. you have to, whenever you see somebody in makeup like that and they're talking like this, it's because it's the only way they can make words get out through like the teeth.
That's why, I mean, I've said this before, but I don't know why there's not like a acting for genre films. How do you act with all, you know, it's like you can take all the theater you want, but all of a sudden when you're, you're basically in something that is hobbled.
Yeah.
All of your movement.
Yeah.
And vision.
Mm-hmm.
How do you continue to?
The vision, the speech, the sometimes depending on the costume, the mobility in the arms. It's a whole different set of challenges. I'm so glad we found a home for the makeup.
Yes, you found a very welcome home.
And from that day forward, the House of Hardwick was haunted. Of all the oddities,
is it the ghost of a fake character?
Just the ghost of James Gunn, like haunt, yelling direction from the back of the house,
or just like late at night, at it's, midnight.
It's metaphor, Christopher Hardwick. It's. Verse.
Did you just hear that? No. My wife feels like there are supernatural things that have happened in this house.
Sure.
I don't subscribe.
You don't subscribe
to that series of books.
Sure.
Of that series.
Do you subscribe to energetic forces that are outside of our understanding?
It'd be funny if you said that and then just shot beams out of your hands.
Hadouken!
And then the audience just hears a... Because I just like blow up against the wall.
And then you guys are never heard from ever again.
Do you subscribe to energetic for... I would subscribe to that.
Yeah.
She's been convinced...
Yeah, what, have things moved?
She's heard someone, she thought I came home one day.
Great.
And heard like footsteps and a door close and I wasn't here.
Now do we believe in like the space, you know, space-time continuum, rips, loops of
I mean, alternate. I guess we believe in theoretical.
That's what I mean.
Like the possibility. No, I can't disprove it.
Not that it's a ghost, but that it's a happening from another time that's overlapping ours for a second. I mean that's where I kind of am into it.
Think of it like, oh yeah, time's all folded in on itself and there are fingerprints that, I don't know. There have been a couple weird things. There was a period of a couple days where there were a couple like weird like light things and noise things, and we came into the dining room over there, and there was just a weird fog, and it wasn't smoke from a fire, and it didn't have an odor, but there was a tangible fog in the room.
In the dining room.
That we did... Okay, stop it. I see a face that you just made.
Will you come...
Are you finally admitting...
I'm not admitting... No, I'm not. But I want
to
make it clear...
I'm giving him a way to admit it.
I'm
100% is.
It is not. It
is... By not, we mean it is.
The look on your face when you darted your head around the corner...
Scared the shit out of you.
And mugged for the camera. There was no camera, but there was a...
Tell us about the fog. We're talking about the fog in the dining room.
My dining room was filled with it, but did he tell you the night that I thought he came home and someone was in the house, but I was here alone?
Will you sit for a second?
All right, sit down.
I want to hear it.
You're not imposing.
So Chris start at the beginning.
It was when we first got the house. At first, I thought Chris was playing bizarre practical jokes that I didn't understand because doors would open and close, and I had a couple slam in my face. And then I found out later he was either across the house or outside.
Right.
So then I was trying to figure out if it was wind or what was going on, recreate it. It was not. These doors were just slamming.
Okay.
And like I said, I thought it was a not funny joke, but it wasn't you.
It wasn't me.
And so then one night I thought that he had come home from work. And I heard him, and not just me, the cat. The cat sort of jumped up in the bed and looked at the door and heard the same
thing. The cat was like, Chris?
Broadway.
No one's fazed by the fact the cat has
language. I heard footsteps, someone talking, walk all the way down the hall and a door close. So I just assumed that Chris had come home from work and was on a call and went into his office. So then 20 minutes come by and I was kind of getting ready for bed. I'm like, that's weird. He hasn't come in yet. That's so odd. So I get up and I go to go, you know, burst into his office and be like, hello. Mm-hmm. It's pitch black. No one's there. There's absolutely nothing. So then I get really confused and I start wandering
around
the house.
Your heart rate elevates.
And I look outside in the driveway and there's no other car here. It's just my car. And the alarm is still set. No one's been in the house. There's nothing.
I love it.
There was, oh, you know, the other kind of weird thing that happened around the dining room fog was that we heard, because we have the alarm in the house, will announce when a door opens, like, side door. And one of the doors announced that it was open. And we couldn't...
And it had been locked. And we Chris watched the security footage, and you can see the door open.
There's a camera aimed at that door.
Do you have the footage?
Yeah.
Excellent. I can't wait to see it.
And John Fernandez, who's upstairs right now helping me with the light switches, has admitted that he's had people come up behind him and tap him on the shoulder, and he thought it was like me or Chris or someone... Turn around, there's no one there.
This is great. I love this so much. Now, obviously I'm not looking for you guys to identify where you live, but does this house have a history? Like
not really. I mean
it's like old people who've lived here or
we're the fourth owners.
Fourth owners.
I know.
Okay.
The previous owners said they never experienced anything.
The provenance of the home. I mean, it's been here a long time. When was it built?
1928.
Yeah.
Oh, here. Okay, here's the footage. I'm going to show you the footage.
Are you going to put this on a website or something for people to see, or are we just describing it?
I don't know where
to just post it when you post this podcast, so you can have them both up.
Okay, so it's about 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. So you can this is the door right here. This is the security camera,
and it's locked.
As far as I know.
All right,
but I don't know. Maybe someone
we're looking. We're looking at a stationary bike. Does the handle move, is it just open?
It just opens. Should be.
We're waiting.
Video's only 38 seconds, so we can tighten this up.
Okay.
In the edit. Here we go.
No. Okay. Now, hold on. Now, does it close again?
No.
Okay.
No,
it just opens. There was a little bit of a movement in the trees behind it.
So
right?
Maybe it was wind.
So. But I'm trying. I want to see if that handle comes down, Katie. Oh, Katie zooms in because she knows how to use phones. All right, we're watching again. The sun is shining.
Is it playing?
It is playing. No. It's the branches are moving in the background. And all of the sudden, without warning, the door opens. And doesn't like
but
swing.
If the door hadn't been latched.
No.
But if it hadn't been latched, you would have known because the system alerts you if any door or window is open.
Right. And it doesn't like open and like slowly swing. It like opens abruptly and like stops.
Right.
Wow, this is great. This is a haunted house. it's official. This house is haunted.
It is.
This is more than I've ever seen, by the way, on any of the ghost shows that we've ever watched. They usually they come in and they go, oh my God, I just got this weird energy. I cannot rule out that this might be Colonel Edward Jackson,
right.
who was a Confederate soldier. And it's like, I think we can rule it out.
I really loved the early Ghost Hunters, though.
It was pretty great.
Because my favorite part was that they didn't deny that their other job was being plumbers. They could have edited. They didn't have to put that in the show.
Well, they're like ghost plumbers.
Yeah. But I did enjoy that. That's how they ruled out certain things. They're like, no, this is plumbing. This is knocking of pipes. This is.
Bye.
This house is not haunted at all.
Man, this podcast has taken so many turns.
Yeah, you've experienced it now.
Yeah,
but you know, I think you're the sweetest man, and I'm so excited for all the amazing things that are happening in your life.
Oh, thanks so much. You just feel the same about
you. Look at your face, and you just see, like, that is a sweet, nice guy.
Hadouken!
Would you deny the existence of energies being harnessed in a matrix of sorts?
Oh, well, thanks for having me to this haunted house.
He brought cherry pies. Chris Sullivan's a fucking awesome guy. Came to my house, went to House of Pies. Sweet cherry pie. Now we say goodbye. Yow!
Yow!
Hey, enjoy your burrito.
Yes! No, we've never had a Beetlejuice enjoy your burrito.
I'm so excited. It worked out.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Now I got to get Michael Keaton on to do a taser face enjoy your burrito. And it's all going to come out. Full circle. Do you want to plug anything? To Write Love on Her Arms?
To Write Love on Her Arms right now is a great place to go if you're looking for help, if you're struggling with depression or anything difficult in your life. They can connect you with help. I'm currently working on a second record with Taylor Goldsmith from Dawes. That'll be out in the next couple of months. And please watch This Is Us.
Where you 100% have vampire blood or something.
Yeah, I think the powers will reveal themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's okay to let that little spoiler.
Yeah.
This is us.
This is us.
This is us. Living life like mortals.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That was the ID10T podcast number 988 with Mr. Chris Sullivan. This is Ending Word Salad, and I just am going to give you a trigger warning up top that this is going to be a sad one, talking about death. And so if you don't want to feel that or listen to that, then now is your chance to not have to. And you don't have to. You're not required to. If you just don't feel like listening to it, that's entirely your prerogative. But I just feel too compelled to say something than to not. It is a very strange coincidence that this episode talked about conversations around mental illness and the organization To Write Love on Her Arms, because I'm sure you probably know, if you listen to this podcast, you probably have some sense of the comedy world, but a friend of mine and a really wonderful guy named Brody Stevens took his own life last week. And if you saw on social media, you know, everyone was posting pictures and telling stories, and people are still really shaken up over it. And I mean, I knew Brody for 20 years, I think. And, you know, he was pretty open about his struggles with mental health. And, you know, at 48, he took his own life. And I don't even know what to say, you know, like, I just know that it sucks and people are not. If you're struggling with mental health issues, I am begging you to please talk to someone. You're not alone. You don't have to be alone. And I just don't want this to happen to anyone else. And if you go to the National Institute of Mental Health website, you can learn more about mental health options, nimh.nih.gov. Also, NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI.org. Just have conversations about it. Be open about it. Talk to people about it. We talked about it in the podcast, just being open. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It's nothing to be ashamed of. Brody did warm up on At Midnight for 2 years, and he was a really wonderful guy. And one of the things that's so heartbreaking is that he was so loved by so many people and so funny, and he couldn't connect to that. And I just keep thinking that it didn't have to happen. And I know that there are people who are closer to him that feel like they... Was there anything they could do? Was there anything they should have done? And I don't... I mean, they can't blame themselves, you know? You can't watch someone 24/7, you know? But just please know that if you're struggling, that you're really not alone. And it was a pretty surreal week too, because my nephew was killed in a car accident the day before the Brody news, and he was 19, and I guess he wasn't wearing a seatbelt, and he was hit at an intersection and I believe lost his life almost instantly. And so I went home to Memphis to be with my family for a couple of days, and I'm sure it's a bummer to listen to, but it was just a really weird week. And the service was really heartbreaking, but special at the same time. His name was Kyle Frazier, and like I said, he was 19, but just so beloved. I mean, I think there were like 1,000 people at his service. They had to turn people away. And just hearing about all of his accomplishments and who he was and who he wanted to be, and how at 19 he was so insightful and helpful to people, that, you know, he worked with his youth ministry group, and they read some messages that he sent out to people who were struggling with, you know, just life, high school life, and he gave one of the most insightful pieces of advice I've ever heard from even any adult. But someone was struggling with something in school, and they were stressed or worried about something, and he wrote a message to them where he said, "When the lion is asleep, it doesn't concern itself with the opinion of sheep." In other words, don't worry about what people who aren't important in your life think. Don't get caught up in what other people are thinking. Just be you. And, you know, he signed off all of his messages, "Stay golden," which was really sweet. He was a really sweet guy, and apparently would help people who were bullied. He was a big football player. Would help people who were bullied, and I don't know. I just wanted to talk about him and honor him, and, you know, I'll miss not getting to see him grow up, and even more, I mean, he was way bigger than I am, but I was very proud of him, and I'm sorry for the depressing end to the podcast, but I just
I just don't want to lose anyone else, so please take care of yourself out there, okay? And I'm good. The family's dealing with it as best they can. They're very strong, and they have a good support structure, and I have a good support structure, and I hope you have a good support structure. And if you don't, please find one, and just know that you're worth it, and to live life to its fullest and pursue the dreams that you can while you can, and appreciate the people that are around you while you have them, okay? I'm sorry, I promise. I promise next week a more cheerful word salad rap. And I'm sorry for getting really sad. But I appreciate you. So thanks, and I'll see you next week. Rest in peace, Brody. Rest in peace, Kyle.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, The Competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.